Good on you, Tony. Thanks for those words, and thanks, David, very much for the honour of being the chairperson this morning. Well, this is an overview which is going to be somewhat different. It promised to be very interesting. I guess, how can it not be? We've got a range of speakers lined up this morning which will give you a flavour as to the global influence on the economy. Clearly, when we talk about where Australia is at the moment, we can't talk about Australia in isolation. The events, particularly in North America, but increasingly throughout Europe and Asia, are going to be extremely influential if they are not already. So Judith Fergan, who is the US Consul General, will lead us off with an overview as to what's happening in the US. Given the American roots of the global financial crisis, it's entirely appropriate that we hear firsthand Judith's update, and certainly the change of administration has brought with it a different outlook. Judith will be followed by Rob Zacharin. Rob is the head of the British Consul, and Rob will bring a UK perspective and also comment on things Europe, both economic and political. And then our final speaker is Michael Knox. Michael is the head of strategy at ABN AMRO Morgans, and he will present essentially an Asia update with a particular focus on China. Given China's involvement and substantial interest in the Australian economy, I'm sure that Michael's commentary will be of much interest to us all. Okay, so the format of this morning is I'm going to provide some introductory remarks and really set the scene, and then we'll have a presentation from each of our three keynote speakers. I'll then elaborate a little and draw out from them, or tease out from them, I guess, some further information by way of questions. After Rob's session, we're going to break for morning tea. We'll then come back for Michael's session, and then we'll bring everyone together in a panel session, and that will really be your opportunity for Q&A from the floor. Okay, so thank you indeed for your time this morning. Your support and obviously continuing interest in CEDA is very much appreciated. We hope that this workshop gives you some information and some messages that you can take home with you. So just a reminder that if you haven't already, can you please silence your mobile phones? Look, when David first approached me about chairing this session, like most academics, I sort of jumped at it because we love the sound of our own voices. But then I started to have second thoughts as I realised exactly the sorts of issues that may be coming up. And the world in which we live is certainly a very dynamic world. And anything I say, or indeed the other speakers say this morning, are likely to be refuted by the financial press when we wake up tomorrow morning. I mean, such is the dynamic and ever-evolving nature of the world in which we live in that I woke up to news this morning that the state has been downgraded in relation to its credit rating. And I thought, well, that was probably something I didn't predict 12 months ago. But, look, as a student of financial markets and the economy for 25 to 30 years, I can honestly say that I've never seen such interesting times. And if it wasn't for the harsh reality of the situation, I would be having an absolutely great time. Because all the things we have learnt about the way in which the economy works and our theories, and the way in which we teach, and we look around for case examples all the time as to why economic theory doesn't quite work, it has all come to fruition. And if I was to put together a bunch of my colleagues and say, think about the sort of worst case scenario you could come up with, and let's construct an experiment and let's make it all happen. Wouldn't that be fantastic? Well, we've got that at the moment, but as I say, the unfortunate thing is it's actually real. And so there is this tempering, if you like, of, my God, this is such a great academic exercise with, hey, hang on, there are people who are losing jobs here, there are businesses which are going bankrupt, and there are major economies which are in trouble. And so the degree of reality has really started to hit home. But you're going to hear various views today, and you have no doubt heard various views over a considerable period of time. Economics is an inexact science, okay? There is no closed-form solution to anything economic. And I'm reminded of a sort of short tale that if you wanted to really gain an expert opinion, you get two opposing economists, perhaps one monetarist, a Friedmanist, and a Keynesian. And you put them in a room together and you'd ask them to come up with a solution. So you've got two guys, you put them in a room. You go and knock on the door after 24 hours and they're still bickering and arguing. Okay, you go and knock on the door after 48 hours and they're still talking at each other. You go and knock on the door eventually after a week and they come out and they say, we've got a solution for you, but we've got four opinions. Look, today's environment is one where you cannot afford to be uninformed, but don't look to anyone or any one commentator or any one media outlet to actually give you the answers. I think the key today is to try and gather information and form your own opinions, and how you then digest that information is ultimately your decision, but I think you cannot afford to be uninformed in today's environment. Look, I remember very well the stock market crash of October 1987, both as a student of financial markets and also, unfortunately, as an investor. I recall the recession we had to have in 1990-91. I recall the Asian financial crisis of 98 and the dot-com boom and bust at the turn of the century. But even though those events were painted at the time as being climactic, they pale into absolute insignificance compared to what's happening today. Let me start by making a controversial suggestion that I believe that the financial crisis is reaching bottom. Okay, now, comments like that, you may want to have me locked up, but I distinguish here between the financial crisis and the consequential effects of the crisis. Okay, and I suggest that in pure financial terms, we are approaching the trough. Now, my reason for saying this is that markets, as we know, are forward-looking by nature. So they anticipate the future. So in this sense, they're very much a leading indicator. And throughout the whole course of history, if you look where markets are, markets have always led the general state of the economy. So the decline in equity values at the moment, on average, is somewhere around about 50% across sectors, across national markets. And 50% is a pretty extreme reaction to any sort of sets of events. Now, it's well accepted that equity valuations, as manifest in modern markets, are a function of future expected cash flows discounted back by some cost of capital. So if we take one example, think about the banking sector in Australia. The Commonwealth has come in and through its deposit guarantee, it's essentially reduced investor risk. That was the whole idea of the Commonwealth guarantee around the deposits, this induced investor risk. So on the one hand, you've actually had a reduction in investor costs of capital. So if you get a decline in banking stocks, as we've seen, of somewhere around about 40 to 50%, the expected decline in cash flows is actually even greater than that, given there's been a reduction in the cost of capital. So the markets are pricing in some absolutely, absolutely dire future forecasts of cash flows. So in this sense, the prices have already incorporated a very, very major doom and gloom scenario. But I'm not alone in holding this view, and if you want some proof of that, just have a look at the actions of the Chinese sovereign funds. I would suggest that their recent entry into the Australian market is not a coincidence, and it is highly indicative of the fact that there are other investors around the world which view markets as having reached somewhat akin to their bottom. I mean, certainly our miners look like very good buyers at the moment in that respect. If those transactions go ahead, we shouldn't underestimate the consequences of them, because those assets are going to be very expensive to buy back later. But, I mean, that's another debate for a separate day, I guess. So let me return to the debate around the current state of the economy, and particularly the consequential effects of the financial crisis. Before we do that, let me meander for a moment and be a little bit academic and talk about definitions. Now, there's much media hype around the economy, and how many times have you seen the quote or the question, is Australia formally in a recession yet? And you're going to see a lot more of this over the coming months. A recession is a technical term invented by a bunch of academics to describe a particular state of the economy, so we can standardise our language and we know what we're talking about. Okay, yes, I know academics have got a lot to answer for, and this is yet another one. Okay, formally, an economy is in recession if it experiences two successive quarters of negative growth. Right, so we take growth typically as GDP, so we're looking for two negative GDP numbers in successive quarters. So given that GDP numbers come out quarterly, it actually takes us 6 months to declare whether or not we're in recession. Now, if you compare that to depression, people talk about, you know, are we ever going to approach depression in this current state? Depression is an entirely different construct. Depression is typically defined as recessionary activity over three successive years, so not two quarters, three successive years, or a drop in GDP of more than 10%. So I'll put those numbers into substance for you in a moment. So where are we at the moment? Technically, the US economy is in recession. It was in recession in the December quarter. Similarly, the UK, Eurozone, Japan, and our neighbours from New Zealand are all technically in recession. Australia is not, however, and this is a sort of interesting debate, if you like, only for the academic senses of it. So our September 08 national account figures reported a seasonally adjusted GDP growth figure of just 0.1%, so just above zero. The December quarter figures are going to be released on the 4th of March, and they're widely expected to indicate negative growth. But given that we look for these technical definitions, it's probably not going to be some time till around about August, September this year that there will be any formalisation as to people running around saying technically Australia is in recession. But my point here is we're going to get hung up on a lot of politicisation of the economy. We've got media one-liners, and the inevitability of the political economy will distract us from the real debate. So let me just give you one number, for instance. If we use GDP per capita as our definition, that is the output per individual person in Australia, we were technically in recession in September last year. Right? So it's a matter of semantics, it's a matter of technical definitions, and as I say, the reality is we know where we are at the moment. Ask those people out in the streets that no longer have jobs, that had jobs 12 months ago, and avoid the politicisation of this debate and of its inevitability. But look, the good news is that really since the Second World War, Australia's been relatively immune from major recession. In the downturn of 82-83, we experienced negative growth in 6 out of 7 quarters, but the total fall of GDP was only around 4% over that two-year period. Similarly, in 1990-91, when the world's greatest treasurer gave us the recession we had to have, the total growth fall was around 2%, from 6 successive quarters of negative growth. So by and large, historically, when Australia has entered recession, it has typically entered recession over a period of around, it's lasted for over a period of around about 18 months, but the falls have actually been relatively small, and so everyone talks about a soft landing. They're classic examples, really, of a soft landing. Okay, so those figures are a long way from the typical depression-type benchmark of a 10% fall in GDP growth, which I referred to earlier. But while Australia is looking relatively okay at the moment, the global downturn has been very substantive. Okay, for instance, the fall in growth that we have witnessed in China exceeds the largest decline in growth in Australia since the 1950s. Okay, albeit it's coming off a higher base, that fall in GDP growth literally over the last 6 months has exceeded anything that we've experienced in Australia since the Second World War. Now, what makes this particular period of economic activity, or dare I say, inactivity, particularly interesting at the moment? Well, four factors. First of all, the sheer size of the downturn. Now, when I talk to students and we use sort of examples, we talk in millions and perhaps billions of dollars. Okay, now we talk in trillions of dollars. I don't even know what $1 trillion is. I know it's a bloody lot, right? The estimated value of losses at the moment is somewhere around about $4 trillion and growing. And of that $4 trillion, about half of it emanates out of the States. Now that sounds a lot, but I do have a silver lining on this, that in terms of percentage of GDP or relative percentage to GDP, the US losses are around about 5% of the US economy. Japan, in contrast, Japan through its recessionary period in the 1990s, its losses were somewhere around about 15% of the Japanese economy. And in the late 1990s, the Asian financial crisis chewed up around about 30% of some of the local country's GDP. So $2 trillion in the US sounds a lot, and it is a lot. But in percentage terms, it's not an historical high. Second, the global contagion which has occurred and the similarity in the downturn across all markets has been one that's taken a lot of people by surprise. Nearly all developed countries are expected to shrink this year, and global growth will be somewhere at best around about 1%. Third, the tightening of credit markets, and I want to say a little bit more about this in a moment, but third, the tightening of credit markets has taken everyone by surprise and has been unheralded in terms of our history. Wholesale lending rates have blown out 350 basis points compared to historical averages of 10 to 20 basis points. And finally, traditional policy mechanisms have failed us. So we have typically utilised a strong monetary policy. Monetary policy tends to work particularly well when you're trying to manipulate demand. In this particular instance, monetary policy hasn't served us well, and we've had amazing economic U-turns in returning to massive Keynesian-type fiscal stimuli. Okay, now let me just return to a textbook case, if you like, of what's happening. And forgive me if I give you or reiterate for you a little bit of Economics 101, but I often find that simplification of complex problems can help your thinking. We know that the national economy, any national economy, has four key components. We have C, which is household expenditure or household consumption, C for consumption. We have G, which is the government side of the fence, which is the government spending and investment. I, which is private sector investment, and in a textbook case, it's X minus M, which is just net exports. So you've got household consumption, you've got government expenditure, you've got private sector investment, and you've got net exports, exports minus imports. Okay, so fiscal theory says that we can boost GDP through stimulating any one of those four. And the advantage typically in stimulating any one of those four is you get crossover effects, so they don't operate in isolation. Okay, so household consumption will assist private sector spending, which has an impact also on imports and exports. Okay, so let's take each of those in turn. Net exports. Well, Australia is in a pretty good position at the moment because the weakening of the Australian dollar combined with the softening of domestic demand has meant that we've essentially redressed a number of years of trade imbalance. And in the second half of last year, we actually recorded a trade surplus, the first time since 2001. But that turnaround is probably going to be short-lived because of the weakening in global demand for our exports. So there's not a lot happening there. And in particular, the downturn in the Chinese economy is going to have a significant effect in relation to our coal and iron ore exports. Queensland is going to feel this particularly hard. Let's turn to government spending. Well, clearly the government's aware of its responsibility here, and the Swan-Rudd stimulus package is explicitly designed to boost government spending. But the problem with government spending is it takes a long time really to come through, and the sort of nature of spending which people are talking about at the moment is infrastructure projects are not ready to go. It's going to be a number of years before those projects actually come online and that spending translates into jobs and real dollars. Consumption, household consumption or consumer spending, the December giveaway of almost $10 billion was designed to compensate for a fall in overall household expenditure. So debate continues as to whether or not that's really had the desired effect. The sort of conversion estimates people talk about are around about 60%, so that for every dollar that was handed out, 60 cents of that worked its way back through the economy. The other 40 cents went into deleveraging strategies or basic savings. But let me turn to this final component, which is not well talked about, and I'm sure that most people in this audience would really understand, and that comes to private sector investment. So to put this in perspective, in Australia last year, new private sector investment, CapEx, in Australia was $86 billion. So that was new private investment, $86 billion. You know, the government stimulus package is $40 billion, so the new expenditure was twice of what the government's talking about pumping in the economy. And in Queensland alone, it was $17 billion. So we're talking about a major component of the economy here. The concern that I have over the so-called private sector investment, is that of all those four components, it has the strongest and the most rapid multiplier effect associated with it. So the multiplier effect is basically when you pump a dollar into one of those four sectors of the economy, the multiplier is how quickly and how strong a dollar spent here will work its way through the system through dollars elsewhere. And it's well known that private sector investment has one of the strongest and largest multiplier effects. So private sector investment is pretty important for us, but that investment is critically dependent upon access to capital. Okay, and herein lies the dilemma. The financial system has basically returned to the old days of credit rationing. So as the banks try and restore confidence in their balance sheets, they're simply not lending, at least on a global level, or at least not lending at rates which are commercially viable rates for businesses to earn to their required rate of return. And the situation is confounded by the government guarantees of the banks, because essentially what's happened is it's taken out the natural competition in the non-bank financial institution sector. So it's really allowed the major banks to shore up their balance sheets and let business opportunities bypass, in the knowledge that their competitors, or at least the non-bank financial sector, is not going to pick those opportunities up. So that's not to criticise the government's decision. It had to do something, but there's been this unintended consequence of it. Now, given that the regulatory requirements concerning capital adequacy around banks force them into low-risk investments or low-risk loans, it's a rational decision for Australian banks, at least, to look towards mortgage lending. Now, the good news of that, or at least first mortgage lending, the good news about that is that bank lending in the mortgage sector should prevent the large declines we've observed in the housing sector offshore. And given the relative imbalance between supply and demand in Australian housing stock, we're likely to have a pretty good floor underneath the Australian housing market. But the Australian banking sector is unlikely to loosen its grip on funds while credit spreads remain at their current levels. So some commentators have argued that the whole global banking system is bankrupt. That is, that the total amount of equity is insufficient to shore up the total amount of net assets. And that's why they're talking about the institution of a bad bank to basically ring fence those toxic and contagious liabilities. But the reality is that there's just not enough credit flowing around. And as I say, if I return to my point about private sector investment, we are essentially foregoing one of those four key components of our economy at the moment. So look, while there are many dissections about the crisis, the origins in relation to the subprime market, and the roots of the problem, the reality is that the problem rests ultimately with the financial system. And my point is that unless that is addressed, the problem is not going to go away. So let me just quote some spreads for you so you have a close feel on this. Spreads in the fourth quarter for medium grade, so these are like BAA rated bonds, were over 5%. The spread on low grade, so B rated bonds, was over 12%. And the spread on AAA rated bonds is still somewhere around about 2%, 200 basis points. So no company is going to be able to conduct its business at those sorts of spreads. So the big challenge really remains is how the Australian economy is going to withstand that contagion from overseas. And here in Queensland, I guess we face a greater challenge given our exposure to China and the falling commodity prices. Look, policy responses by the state government really are not going to be particularly effective. Just as we have problems with trying to implement a carbon policy in Australia, the reality is that we are just such a small player relative to what's happening globally. The same thing here. So if we look to state governments for support, or we hear various politicians saying our decisions are shoring up the economy, it's rubbish. Right? There needs to be at least a completely united response at the federal level, but that federal level response has really got to be seen in light of what's happening globally. So to a summary and to some famous predictions here for you, David. So on monetary policy, the RBA board has decreased the official rate 5 times. It's more than halved the rate from 7.25% in March last year to the current rate of 3.25%. These shifts in monetary stance are unprecedented, certainly in a relative sense, but expect more to come, albeit at a slowing speed. The RBA's commentary suggests that it doesn't want too many policy triggers operating at once. And one of the difficulties that the RBA has is that it only has control over monetary policy. Fiscal policy is sitting with a politicised government. And at a stage, at times like this, you really need the two working hand in hand. So the RBA is a little hamstring because it's almost got to second guess what the fiscal reactions will be by the policymakers in Canberra. So Governor Stevens is talking about a turnaround, but look, I mean, such talk has clearly got to be within his job description, right? History suggests that the RBA is naturally cautious and will wait for firm economic data. It has a strong track record in waiting for firm economic data before making decisions. So expect there to be a slowdown in the reduction in the cutting rates. And also the RBA will be conscious of wanting to provide a floor for the Aussie dollar. So the interest rate differential it'll try and maintain a little bit. Expect our currency to come under increased pressure, particularly in light of declining commodity prices. Look, there's a lot of argument for devaluation around the greenback, the US dollar at the moment. That argument is very meritorious. But the reality is, if you're arguing the greenback's going to depreciate, you've got to argue that there's another currency which is going to appreciate, and it's not obvious what that other currency will be. So despite our nationalistic pride, the reality is the Aussie dollar is actually a speculative currency, seen as a speculative currency, and so there's going to be a flight to traditional markets. There will be much talk about the effects of the domestic stimulus, but that'll be driven by political agendas. And as the Rudd government moves through its second year, it's going to be challenged by balancing its vocal commitment to reform with the harsh reality of the global economy. Expect a diversion around the definition of the true state of the Australian economy, as I've suggested. The reality is for many people on the ground is their net worth has actually declined, unemployment is on the rise, asset values are unlikely to rebound in the near future, and business is going to struggle to continue to access capital. Finally, keep an eye on inflation. This may sound ironic, and David referred to it earlier, but the inflation genie was out of the bottle at this time last year. Just 12 months ago, the inflation genie was so-called out of the bottle. But the rapid decline in costs, particularly energy and falling demand, has meant that deflation is now a distinct possibility, certainly globally. The difference between yields on the nominal 10-year US bonds and the real index-linked bonds is now down to just 25 basis points, 0.25%, the difference between real and nominal rates on 10-year US bonds. So the market's basically pricing in zero inflation in the US. The problem with deflation is that the natural reaction to deflation is to delay consumption, the very reverse of what the policymakers and economists want us to do. So deflation exacerbates a downturn. So it's not all doom and gloom. Certainly opportunities are going to present themselves, and history is full of examples of businesses and individuals that have prospered out of dark economic times. The key is obviously to be innovative in your thinking, and as I tell my children every day when they're going off to school, the glass is always half full, never half empty. So that's it from me. That's the overview, and I want to now turn to the first of our very illustrious and high-profile speakers and welcome Judith Fergan to the stage. So Judith is the US Consul General. This is her second stint in Australia, and it's a great pleasure in meeting Judith. She told me this morning that she is absolutely loving Australia, particularly the second time around. She loves Brisbane. She's now living in Sydney, and she has worked and travelled, I think, pretty close to every continent other than Antarctica around the world. So, Judith, it's fantastic to have you up here in Brisbane, and we look forward to your remarks.